Hope in the fight against Ebola. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's Wednesday, March 4th. In West Africa, the fight against Ebola continues, and young kids in Sierra Leone are volunteering to help track down new Ebola cases.
You'd think reporting on Ebola is all doom and gloom, but when you see these young people just incredibly capable, incredibly passionate about what they're doing, it's really something positive.
Plus, Los Angeles gets a new mosque, one run exclusively by women for women.
The single most empowering thing that I ever did as a Muslim woman was to read the Quran in a language that I understand.
Also, we take you down to Ville Platte, Louisiana, where a Creole language radio station is the talk of the town.
If you die and they don't hear it on KVPI, you're not dead.
That's all ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Second Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, the new comedy directed by John Madden, starring Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Bill Nighy, Dev Patel, and Richard Gere, in theaters everywhere Friday.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It happened just before we went on air on April 15th, 2013. Two bombings near the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Today, almost 2 years later, the trial of the surviving suspect got underway here in Boston. We'll talk about what happened on day one later on The World, but let's start with an update on a very different kind of tragedy, Ebola. We've been hearing recently that the outbreak in West Africa has been waning. That is good news, but the crisis is far from over. New York Times correspondent Sherry Fink has just returned from Sierra Leone, where she witnessed a new flare-up of Ebola. It began near a wharf in Freetown known as Tambakula. Sherry, describe the area for us.
You've got your reclaimed wood shacks with the corrugated roofs, people living in really tight proximity, garbage everywhere. There had just been a block of toilets put in by Oxfam just a few months ago, but otherwise people kind of making do with the sea. And I should point out the proximity of the settlement to the fanciest hotels in town. So where all the public health workers are staying at the Radisson and other hotels that have this beautiful, beautiful ocean view, these little, you know, informal settlements or slums, whatever you want to call them, are in the in-between areas along the shore.
Wow.
And so the boats, these wooden fishing boats that go out to sea, they came in and one of the boats returned early because several crew members were sick, including the captain.
These are fishermen, is that right?
These are fishermen who go out to sea and spend a week or two fishing, mostly snapper.
Is there any idea of how men at sea contracted the disease?
They're not sure. It could be that the men, when they're out fishing, they do stop at little islands and they meet with fishermen from other places. And then, of course, there are other coastal areas where the fishermen stop that include some areas that were hot spots at that time for Ebola.
How did this neighborhood of Tambakula know that these men might be sick with Ebola, and how did they deal with it?
So the men came back from sea early. They were sick on the boat. And then some of the men voluntarily went to get looked at a health facility. And that's how these first cases were detected. And then the health officials and these teams of, you know, volunteer students and public health officials, both from Sierra Leone and the U.S. CDC and some British organizations, they started to go out and systematically go through these fishing communities along the coast. And they found more and more cases.
So it went further. The one patient who was taken away from these wharves in Tambakula by his wife, this led to 42 other cases in a time when things seemed to be heading towards zero.
Yeah, so this is something that I witnessed. I was spending time with the teams going out in Tambakula, trying to detect any other people who were getting sick, get them right away to treatment facilities. And then I heard from somebody with the International Medical Corps, a nonprofit that has a treatment center in McKinney, which is about 3 hours from the capital. And he said, you know, we've got all these cases now that trace back to Tambakula, to this one young man. Well, he got sick in Tambakula. His wife and mother were involved in bringing him back to his home village. And then out of that, and I went to this community and spent about a week there, this little village called Rosanda, where just person after person was getting sick all of last week. Every day, the ambulances bumping down these dirt roads to pick up children and women and men who had been sickened, all from this one individual who had left this area of Tamakula and gotten away under cover of night. And I spoke with a mother, and she said, you know, we saw this as a traditional problem, not as a medical problem. And they sought a traditional healer who then got sick and died. Then I spoke with some scientists about how do you get down to zero? Is this common in outbreaks that you have these bumps in the road? They're now calling it the bumpy road to zero.
Right.
And they were saying, yeah, sometimes problems that were hidden when you had a raging outbreak become clear when you're down to just a few cases. And so here we saw maritime spread that really isn't something we've really talked about before, the difficulty of controlling wooden fishing boats going out. And so now there's a big effort to catalog those boats and mark down who's going out and where they go and when they come back and testing them, maybe even putting hand washing stations on little wooden fishing boats. That's one effort that I heard being discussed.
In this one episode, you were talking about the people who are walking through the slums trying to track down the new cases. And you said many of them are student volunteers. What did they say motivated them in what must be a pretty darn risky job?
There's a lot of concern now amongst some of the public health professionals about, well, if we do open schools, what's going to happen to all of these wonderful volunteers? They're going to be carrying their school books back to school rather than hitting the streets every day with these prevention messages. But what seemed to motivate them, it's almost like you get the same story from everyone you ask. This is my country. I'm doing this not for money. A lot of them haven't been paid anything. I'm doing this to try to get Ebola out of my country. And they're just like, they're so passionate and they're so inspiring. And you'd think reporting on Ebola is all doom and gloom. But when you see these young people just incredibly capable, incredibly passionate about what they're doing, it's really something positive.
Sherry Fink with The New York Times, just back from Sierra Leone. Thank you very much for your time, Sherry.
Thank you.
Sierra Leone's economy has taken a huge hit during the Ebola crisis. There are food shortages caused by farmers leaving their fields. Foreign workers are staying away, and a number of airlines still won't fly there. And that's just a partial list of the problems facing businesses in Sierra Leone. Aid money and donations from the U.S. and other countries have helped, but it's not enough. Momo Conte is a businessman who splits his time between Sierra Leone and the U.S. He told the BBC that the private sector can bring new hope to Sierra Leone, just as it's done before.
If you remember civil war from 1991 to 1998, the private sector restarted the whole economy again. So that is what we're going to see immediately after the end of the Ebola crisis in our country.
The government of Sierra Leone already developed a post-Ebola recovery plan to encourage private investment and stimulate growth. Conte says one area ripe for private investment, infrastructure, things that anybody would like to see in their neighborhood, like new roads and better utilities.
My family definitely would benefit because I'm coming from the northernmost part of the country, very rugged, very bad, and my mom is living there. So personally, I'll definitely benefit. And besides, my countrymen in other parts of the country like will definitely benefit from this kind of investment.
But unfortunately, Sierra Leone has a dodgy reputation as a place to do business. Corruption and mismanagement have meant that millions of dollars earmarked for the country's Ebola response have disappeared. Conte says, look at the bigger picture, though, because every country has some level of corruption.
So saying that Africa is a corrupt continent or my country is a corrupt country, it's a relative term. I believe there are, you know, of course, you know, bad people within the society, but there are also very good people, and there have been also very good government coming in.
Momo Conte, a businessman from Sierra Leone, he was speaking there to our friends at the BBC. For some better news on the Ebola front, let's turn to neighboring Liberia. The good news there is that Liberia has just had a full week without any new Ebola infections. But even as the situation appears to be improving, a new problem has emerged. What to do with the thousands of tons of Ebola-infected sewage still being stored at treatment centers? My colleague, the BBC's Mark Doyle, is in Liberia, and he's been trying to find out what officials are planning to do with all that sewage.
I'm not sure, actually, that anybody knows for certain, but the Liberian Water and Sewage Corporation boss, a guy called Frankie Castle, said that they have capacity in a big holding tank, which they've got, which is an old sewage works. They have capacity for 2 million gallons of Ebola poo, not to put too fine a language on it, because that's what it is, and that's what they're going to be transferring from the various treatment centres to one place where it will be, they say, held safely.
And what does Monrovia's sewage plant look like? Does it instill confidence?
Not a huge amount of confidence in terms of what it looks like, but the people who are running it, I think, are good people. This, of course, is a completely unprecedented situation anywhere in the world, so international help is required. Organizations like the World Health Organization are helping with, like, medical and testing kits, telling them how long this poo will be dangerous for. Everyone thinks that Ebola poo only remains dangerous, as it were, for 7 days. That's the guess. But like everything in this unprecedented outbreak, no one can be certain. And so they want to store it all in one place and try and keep it safe. But I have to say there are vegetable fields around this place. So I hope it doesn't seep into the ground. And of course, with the best will in the world, even if you control the people with a fence, albeit a relatively flimsy fence, there are still animals, and no one quite knows whether animals might be able to pick this stuff up, and then birds might fly, or geckos or lizards might move around on the ground.
Yeah, seems like a lot of windows of opportunity for this thing to spread. So you've got to move these big plastic tanks filled with this Ebola poo. How do the people of Monrovia feel about that? Aren't people talking about, you know, the possibility of one of these trucks crashing if they do get it transported or leaking?
Well, I'm sure people are worried about every aspect of this business. In fact, I can tell you that just a few days ago, the first transfer actually did take place. It did take place somewhere in Monrovia to this treatment center. And so the Ebola poo gets transferred into a big tankers, and then the tankers roll through town. And the idea is that they're not allowed to stop, because there might be some danger if they were to stop. So they go through town, they go to the depot, and that's where it's offloaded and put into this huge tank. Now, there will be safety teams on standby, as it were, in case anything happens to any of the lorries. But certainly the lorry that I saw was a spanking new International Committee of Red Cross tanker, which didn't look like it was likely to break down. There was some debate about whether they should have sirens and police cars accompanying these tankers and so on. But I think on the whole, they decided that that was probably not a good idea, because that would create more fear and suspicion than just the tanker rolling through Monrovia.
Mm. As you describe all this, though, Mark, it strikes me there's some odd parallels with how Japan is trying to figure out what to do with its nuclear waste. I mean, both very risky propositions.
Well, yes, this is in some ways, I suppose, the biological equivalent of nuclear waste being trundled through Monrovia. But it's only almost the biological equivalent, because, as I say, I certainly wouldn't want to create any panic and suggest that this stuff is incredibly, incredibly dangerous. The government and the aid agencies think that it's probably okay, but they're just being double sure by moving it all to one place where they can keep an eye on it.
This problem with the Ebola poo, it's just one of those post-crisis problems. Are there other challenges that you've seen that the West African countries are facing trying to return to normal right now?
Well, absolutely. I mean, this crisis really put ordinary life on hold in all three countries, and indeed it's still on hold in many senses. Just take the example of schools, for example. The schools were supposed to reopen about a month ago in Liberia, and in fact I originally went to Liberia to do a story about the reopening of schools. Unfortunately, that was postponed because they decided that they hadn't yet distributed all of the things that they need to the individual schools, including buckets so that the kids can wash their hands in a chlorine solution, thermometers to measure the temperature of the children as they come into school, because if you have a temperature above, say, 38 degrees, then it's considered to be a potential risk. Awareness is certainly very high amongst ordinary people that measuring temperature and keeping an eye on everyone's health is very, very important.
My colleague at the BBC, Mark Doyle, thank you for the update, Mark.
Thank you.
Franglais on Bayou Radio, later here on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Have been hearing about this volcano in Chile? Well, imagine you live near it, and you're woken up in the middle of the night by a siren. Then you look out your window, and you see the volcano erupting in spectacular fashion. You don't need to imagine. That's what thousands of people went through yesterday in southern Chile. We spoke with three of those witnesses, the owner of a hostel located near the volcano, and two of his foreign guests.
The name of the volcano is Villa Rica. We are in Pucón. That's about 900 kilometers from Santiago, the capital of Chile, at the south. And last night, we saw from my deck a huge, like a bullet of magma, almost like twice the size of the volcano. It was spectacular, very nice. And then it started to flow through the volcano and start to come down. I was a little bit scared because it's my first experience with an eruption like that.
So I was asleep and our neighbor in the hostel came and knocked on our door and was like, oh, you need to go look out the window, look out the window.
A little before three, there was some yelling and screaming stuff out on the street, car horns going off, that kind of thing. And we looked out the window and saw the top of the volcano and it was spewing lava and ash into the air. Pretty high.
It was pretty impressive and way bigger than we were expecting. So we quickly put on some jackets and went out to witness it.
It was bright red, orange lightning crashing through the ash and lava spewing out all over the place.
It was so much more than we were expecting, smoke and ash, but that was luckily being blown in the other direction. So didn't really feel any danger.
The ash cloud above was immense. It was incredible. And it just looked like a giant flame candle on top of this mountain. It was so bright.
The Spanish name is Villa Rica. The Aborigine name, it's Ruca Pillan. Ruca, it means house, and Pillan, devil or spirit. So it's the house of the devil or the house of the spirit.
We weren't sure whether we should be packing our things and getting out or not, having never been through that experience before. But it was more of a sense of awe than fear.
For now, I think I'm safe. Well, you never know with geology. I mean, I've been reading for a while about the history about the volcano, and I know it's not going to make like a big, big eruption. I hope, because you never know.
Nature is so powerful. So I think we're probably going to pack up our stuff just in case we have to evacuate.
That was Alyssa Moore from Texas. She and Canadian Chris Vidora were staying at a hostel in Pucón, Chile, when the volcano next door erupted. We also heard from the hostel owner, Jose Reyes. You ought to see some of those dramatic images of the volcano erupting. You can at PRI.org. It takes a village, they say, but sometimes all it takes is a mom. A 39-year-old mother has broken wide open a national conversation in China about air pollution. Chai Jing is a well-known journalist and author, and she's made a 104-minute video called Under the Dome. People find it compelling because it's very personal, like when she interviews a girl in one of China's most polluted provinces.
She asked the little girl, has she ever seen stars? And she says, no. And she said, have you ever seen blue sky? And she says, I've seen a little bit of blue sky. And then she asks her, have you ever seen white clouds? And she says, no. That's very compelling to imagine a six-year-old child never seeing these things that most people in Western countries would take for granted.
Jenny Duggan is a freelance journalist in Shanghai. She says Chai Jing's film has created an enormous buzz in China since it came out over the weekend.
It really has gone completely viral. I think at last count, I read today that there are estimates that it has received 200 million hits.
And no censorship. I mean, the film does take aim at government policy. I gather the state-run news media have promoted it.
Yeah, that's right. There certainly has been a lot of discussion about it here, or certainly a lot of coverage of it here in the state-run media. Also, online discussion of the program, of the documentary, has so far been allowed. It's been discussed very widely, very openly on Weibo, the Chinese version of Twitter, other online forums, all of these things that are routinely censored, but it has been allowed to be discussed and debated.
Mm. You mentioned, Jenny, the compelling story of filmmaker Chai Jing, which seems to have resonated with a lot of viewers. She drives the film, much like Al Gore drove Inconvenient Truth. What is Chai Jing's story? I know she had a daughter who was born with a benign tumor. Does she blame bad air for that condition?
No, she didn't link her daughter's condition to air pollution in any way, shape or form. Like, she didn't try and, you know, and link the two. I think that would probably be an impossible thing to do. But she said that it certainly made her much more aware of the pollution. She said prior to having her daughter, it wasn't something that she really thought about. I mean, she was aware of it like everybody else, but it wasn't a big concern, a big fear. But she said that after having her daughter, she felt afraid, you know, and now she said she keeps her daughter indoors. She lives in Beijing, where the air quality last year, I think Beijing had more than 170 polluted days last year.
Wow.
And Chai Jing describes about how she has to keep her daughter indoors for, I think she said, half of the year last year. And she feels like she's keeping her daughter a prisoner.
So it's a compelling film for Chinese. But is there anything to suggest that they or the Chinese central government are ready to change their habits, change their lifestyles?
Yeah, I think so. I think the Chinese government are very aware that air pollution is a really big topic among people. It's a huge, huge concern. And also the Chinese politicians themselves, I mean, they live in Beijing. They have to breathe the same air as everybody else. So it certainly is a really big concern.
You're a mother as well, Jenny. I know Shanghai isn't as bad as Beijing in terms of pollution, but it's still pretty bad. How much do you worry about the impact of the bad air on your kid?
Yeah, in Shanghai, our air isn't as bad as Beijing, but this winter hasn't been particularly great. So you worry about it on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, what does that mean when you say it's not particularly great? Like, do you have to walk out with a face mask, or do you ever have days where you just don't leave the house?
Yeah, to both, yeah. Most people I know have an app on their phone that checks the air quality, and certainly every parent I know checks it every morning. So instead of checking what the weather is like, we check what the air quality is like. And if it's bad, it'll determine what you do on a day-to-day basis, so particularly with young children. So if it's unhealthy or very unhealthy, you know, you might just cut down outdoor activities. You mightn't go to the park, for example. Most people I know with children, and it's certainly a big thing in Shanghai and Beijing anyway, families would have an air purifier at home. So the air purifier would be turned on. If it goes up a notch to very unhealthy, yeah, the face masks would probably come out. If it goes to hazardous, probably avoid going outdoors.
Right.
Turn the air purifier up to high.
Journalist Jenny Duggan in Shanghai telling us about the film Under the Dome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you can see that film with English subtitles at PRI.org. So will Under the Dome be China's moment of reckoning about air pollution, like the 60s were here in the U.S.?
If you visit American City, you will find it very pretty. Just two things of which you must beware. Don't drink the water and don't breathe the air. Pollution!
The great Tom Lehrer in 1965. We had songs like that in the 60s, and books like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and the crying American Native public service announcement. Maybe now is when the people of China come to the realization that wearing face masks and staying indoors just isn't sustainable in the long run.
Fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly, but they don't last long if they try. Pollution, pollution.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Pan-Arabia Inquirer is like The Onion for the Arab world. Its editor says satire can and should tackle anything, including ISIS.
It's bloodthirsty and dangerous, but just absolutely far-fetched and totally removed from reality. So I think it's our job as satirists to try and highlight that.
That story just ahead, right here on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. There is a major military operation underway in Iraq to take back the city of Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown, now in the hands of ISIS. And the U.S. is sitting this one out. It's the Iraqi army and Iranians who are leading this fight. I asked Ayman Jawad Al-Tamimi to help explain why that is. He's a fellow at the Philadelphia-based Middle East Forum.
If I were a policymaker in the U.S. government, it's a very, very difficult situation indeed. On the one hand, if you scale back aid or military support, even conditionally, it creates a bigger vacuum for Iran to fill. And I think this Tikrit operation is a case in point. There's no air support coming, so the Iranian involvement is greater than ever in terms of operational support, logistics on the ground, and so on. But then on the other hand, there are valid concerns that, you know, engaging in airstrikes, providing weapons, then this is going to end up in the hands of Iranian proxy groups in Iraq that have greatly built up their influence.
I mean, we're also hearing reports, Ayman, that Iraqi officials are upset that Iran is more engaged than the U.S. in this fight for Tikrit. And if they had U.S. support in taking Tikrit, the fight would be over by now. Just practically, how much does Iraq need the U.S. right now?
I think on this question of the of U.S. support in this particular operation, I don't think it would make all that much of a difference. It might speed up things a little, but the biggest problem is on the ground, in that undetonated IS IEDs planted all over the roads and in buildings in Tikrit. That's for something to be disarmed on the ground. A U.S. airstrike can't exactly take care of that.
I mean, one of the challenges the Iraqi government has been facing is how to win back the Sunni tribes who have made alliances with ISIS. Is there any sign that you know of that they're getting them back on their side?
I think to a certain extent that has already happened. There are already Sunni forces working with the Iraqi government, but now in Tikrit and also in other places, for example, in Haditha in Anbar province. Although it's common to point to IS sometimes buy into the IS narrative that's protected Sunnis, in reality, there have been abuses by IS against locals in Tikrit since its takeover of the city in the summer of 2014. And I think sometimes that gets overlooked.
So I'm looking at a map of Iraq. Tikrit, it's about halfway up the highway north out of Baghdad to Mosul. Mosul, obviously also held by ISIS. Why the battle for Tikrit right now?
There is this conception that the Battle of Tikrit is a practice, so to speak, or practice ground for the operation to take Mosul. And incidentally, if you were to ask me what are my bets on how this operation is going to go, I think it's going to go in the government's favor. But on the other hand, one has to be very careful about this because the circumstances of Mosul and Tikrit are quite different. Mosul is a much, much larger city, and more significantly, Mosul is not a ghost town. It still has a large local population residing in the city, difficult for them to get out, whereas Tikrit really became depopulated a long time ago.
Ayman, what is your big worry right now with this whole dynamic? Iraqi army, Shia militia from Iran, the U.S. kind of on the sidelines?
Well, if we talk about the U.S. policy role, I mean, I know concerns expressed that the U.S. is or is at risk of losing Iraq to Iran. But my view actually is the U.S. already lost Iraq to Iran a while ago. I mean, the circumstances that the U.S. is in terms of policy debate about what can and can't be done with regards to this means that I think Iran always has the advantage in this regard of being Iraq's neighbor, being more willing to supply military aid readily, being willing to help cultivate forces on the ground, even if they are proxy militias, which in my view, in the long run, create problems, not just in terms of the sectarian dynamic, but I think this is overlooked in the debate, is the question of the militification simply leads to more ample opportunity for lawlessness in the long run.
You sounded fairly confident earlier that ISIS could be defeated. It sounds like you're concerned about the unpredictable stuff down the road a ways.
Right, exactly. And I think this is what we have to bear in mind. And I think sometimes people, when it comes to the militia phenomenon, focus a bit too much on the sectarian issue rather than the just more general problems that militification creates.
Ayman Jawad Al-Tamimi, fellow at the Middle East Forum, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So if you want to make fun of what's happening in the Middle East, go ahead. Years ago, it might have seemed taboo, but satirists don't really hold back much these days, even after the Charlie Hebdo massacre in Paris. The Pan-Arabia Inquirer, it's a perfect example. It's an online satirical news outlet that's been called the Middle East version of The Onion. Here's a typical headline. The Islamic State has sensationally won the prestigious 2015 Turner Prize for its conceptual art piece, Smashing Mosul Museum to Pieces, Death to the Infidels. We tracked down the editor of the Pan-Arabia Inquirer, who agreed to an interview but asked to remain anonymous. First, sir, why do you want to remain anonymous?
Well, I think it's for a variety of reasons. I mean, there's the idea of keeping the mystery over the website. I think, you know, if people found out who we actually were, it wouldn't be quite so interesting. And also because myself and fellow writers all have full-time jobs and we'd like to keep it that way.
Are you based in the Arab world, in the Mid East?
We're scattered around. I was based in the Middle East for quite a number of years and have only just recently departed, and the writers that send in stuff are out there on the ground and, you know, coming up with ideas and seeing what goes on around them. And, you know, it's the area still holds a very special place close to my heart.
What prompted you to start the Pan-Arabia Enquirer?
Mainly, it was to keep myself amused. People expect it to have started with some kind of grand plan to introduce satire to the region or to do this, that and the other. But it really started just because it made me laugh. And the fact that it seemed to have made other people laugh along the way is just a bonus, really.
And are those contributions coming from Arab and Muslim satirists?
Yeah, absolutely. They're coming from all over. I have contributions coming in from Lebanon, from Saudi Arabia, from Egypt, all over. That's, I think, what makes it quite special is that it is the ideas come in from all sides of life. In fact, some of our best stories have come in from Arabic readers.
Give me an example of a story that people thought was real and kind of got some nerves slightly frayed.
Our most popular story was one which was about a year and a half ago, which was a story that said Emirates Airlines was going to introduce a shisha lounge on their A380 planes.
The hookah pipe.
Yeah, exactly, the hookah pipe. And it's the sort of thing that, you know, if you think about it, it's obviously nonsense. You know, there's no way on earth. But it's just about close to the truth that some people picked up on it. And it became a bit of an overnight sensation, so much so that the website couldn't handle the amount of hits that were coming in, and it crashed after a couple of hours. And we had people having online fights in the comments section over, you know, whether it was a good idea or a bad idea, and people were wading in with all sorts of arguments. And eventually, I got one of the funniest letters I've received, which was somebody had actually got in touch with Emirates and they'd been forced to issue some sort of official release saying that it was just a joke, the website was satirical, and they definitely had no plans to introduce hookah pipe lounges on their planes. And this person sent it to me, and underneath it had written, "So stop spreading your lies," obviously having not read the bit at the top, which clearly states this is a satirical website.
We talked about the ISIS conceptual art piece earlier that you guys wrote about. Do you ever take on ISIS in a more kind of really raw way?
They're such a sort of terrifying group at the moment and so dominating headlines from the region that I think what we've tried to do is take them on and try to ridicule them as much as possible, and try to, the piece we did today about the Turner Prize, it was just, you know, it's such an awful thing that happened that we just have to try and give it some spin to diminish the depressing nature of it all, I suppose. I think a lot of what we do is just purely to continue to ridicule what they're doing, because on one side it's absolutely terrifying, but on another side it's absolutely far-fetched and totally removed from reality. So I think it's our job as satirists to try and highlight that.
You have one headline today, 50 Shades of Grey, to include scenes praising UAE leadership. That's pretty good. Suggesting that's all the producers need to do to get distribution in the UAE. Is there anything off limits?
Yeah, there are areas that I probably wouldn't go to. I think most areas involving religion, it's just a bit of a no-go zone. Again, we're not setting out to offend people, so... Also, I mean, we don't want, if the website was blocked, which, you know, governments in the region are very quick at doing, that would lose all our audience. So we have to be slightly careful about how we tone things. And I think we've managed to find that fine line of pushing boundaries without stepping massively over.
That was the editor of the Pan-Arabian Enquirer, a satirical news site about the Middle East with a brand of humor very similar to The Onion's. This next story does venture into the area of religion, but it's not satire. This story is about one of the newest mosques here in the U.S. It's in downtown Los Angeles, and it's different from all the others. Naomi Gingold tells us why.
L.A., Hollywood, movie glamour, these are the things that typically come to mind when you think of Southern California. But there's also this. The area is home to one of the country's largest Muslim populations. Hasna Masnavi is in both of these worlds. She works in film, writes comedy, and recently opened a mosque, something she's dreamed about doing since she was 7.
My idea of what this mosque would be like was very different at every stage of my life and depending on what I was going through and what I thought it could do for the community.
As a kid, she went to a popular mosque in L.A., But when it started requiring women to pray in the balcony and not the same room as the men, she began to feel disconnected from her community, but not her faith.
So after 9/11, I hate that Muslim stories always have to do with that, but how can you not, right? It really changed life for a lot of us.
With Islam under so much scrutiny, Masnavi decided to read the Quran herself.
I went into it thinking that I was going to find all hell and damnation, but I found this loving, generous, forgiving God in the Quran. And so my concept of what Islam was and is drastically changed from my knowledge of the Quran. The single most empowering thing that I ever did as a Muslim woman was to read the Quran in a language that I understand. No matter what cultural practices I saw, I knew my rights in Islam, and I knew that those rights that I had were God-given.
She began learning about Islam's rich history of women scholars and realized she wanted to hear from them. That's when she put her plan into action to create a mosque for and run by women. Earlier this year, the Women's Mosque of America held its first service in downtown LA, in the kind of multi-faith space Masnavi dreamed of. While women's mosques exist in other parts of the world, this is a first in the States. Masnavi says they braced for some backlash, but feedback has been mostly positive, including from imams across the U.S. But not everyone is happy. Mustafa Umar is an imam at one of Southern California's largest mosques.
My biggest issue is there's no need for these. So why do it? It reinforces that stereotypical portrayal of Muslim women as being oppressed. And I just don't feel that it's the case here in Southern California.
His mosque has plenty of programs for women, he says. But to Mona Hanouni, Imam Umar misses the point. She's a congregant at the women's mosque now and says she stopped going to other local mosques because she just felt marginalized.
I never felt I could get close enough to the imam to ask him any questions, or I would have to ask my dad to go and do that. And I've never dreamed that this would be possible. I mean, this just blew my mind.
And the media also can't seem to get enough of the new mosque.
And we're not the usual, you know, anytime you see Muslim women being covered in the media, there's always a veil pun in the title. There's always, you know, an image of a woman in Afghanistan.
Masnavi says the coverage can miss the larger picture.
Even if mosques had perfectly equal spaces and state-of-the-art everything, we would still do this. We would still have this women's mosque because women just need a safe space to be with their sisters.
She sees this mosque as filling the same purpose as, say, a women's college. And so far, the empowerment thing seems to be working. The woman who gave the sermon at a recent service had never given one before. She'd written plenty, but they'd just been read by men at other mosques. Next, Masnavi hopes the movement will grow.
I always imagined that it would spread to different chapters across America and that women from neighboring mosques could go there for empowerment, sisterhood, inspiration, a chance to deliver a khutbah, and then go back to their local mosque and join the boards of those mosques empowered now.
At a recent service, an 8-year-old congregant visiting from out of town raised her hand and asked,
"Can you put a female mosque in Connecticut?"
It's a bit hard to hear, but she said, "Can you put a female mosque in Connecticut?" And considering the excited response Masnavi has gotten from women near and far, maybe soon she'll get her wish. For The World, I'm Naomi Gingold, Los Angeles.
Beto Arcos is a frequent contributor to The World. He lives in L.A., where he reports on Latin music. Now, a Mexican documentary crew is reporting on him, a Mexican who made good in America.
When they first approached me about it, I kind of just sort of laughed. Really? Are you sure you want to do a story on me? This is kind of odd.
His story, tomorrow on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings and legal plans featuring attorney contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World, coming to you from Boston, where today the trial of Johar Tsarnaev got underway. He's accused of bombing the 2013 Boston Marathon. Those bombings literally shook this city, shook the world, both this program and the world at large. Three people killed near the finish line on Boylston Street, just 5 miles from where I am. Many more lost limbs, were wounded, and permanently scarred.
One of the first pieces of evidence that came up was a video showing the bombs. We've all seen it. We've all seen those explosions and the smoke rise over Boylston Street. But, you know, when I saw it today, it felt like it did the first time I saw it. It felt like a punch in the gut.
Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe was in the courtroom today. I asked him for his top headline.
4 minutes. That's the time the prosecution says that Johar Tsarnaev stood next to the children whose bodies he tore apart with those bombs. 4 minutes. And I guess the follow-up headline is that the defense admits this. Judy Clark, the defense lawyer, got up and basically said, or actually she directly said, he did it. But they were going to dispute certain elements of what the prosecution laid out. Mostly, she said they wanted to challenge the whole why. The prosecution, in the form of Bill Weinreb, said that Johar Tsarnaev did what he did on Patriots Day in 2013, because he wanted to avenge the killing of Muslim people at the hands of the American government. And that's why he did that. Judy Clark suggested there are other reasons. She said that Tamerlan Tsarnaev, Johar's older brother, he led and Johar followed. They made it very clear that this is my brother made me do it defense.
So the defense is pretty tightly painted into a corner. How did Johar Tsarnaev look?
He looked as he usually looks. He walked in not showing much emotion when the jury entered, and he put his hands in his pockets, which I guess a lot of 21-year-old kids would do in that circumstance. But he has remained sort of a study in stoicism through all of this. He has not shown much emotion. He hasn't looked at the jury that often, and he's keeping his eyes, you know, askance. He's just not looking at. He's not looking at the people that literally hold his life in their hands.
Well, his defense team has tried really hard to get this trial moved outside of Boston, but it is taking place here, and there are quite a few survivors and relatives of victims in the courtroom. What was the mood overall?
Well, obviously, for the people that were there, victims, I mean, at one point, you know, while they were describing this carnage, and particularly what those bombs did to the bodies of 8-year-old Martin Richard and Lindsay Liu, the Boston University grad student, and Crystal Campbell, who were killed at the marathon, right. You know, the Richard family, Denise and Bill Richard, who lost a son, Heather Abbott, who lost a leg, and Dick Donahue, the transit police officer, who nearly lost his life in the capturing of the suspects. They were sitting there in the courtroom, just yards away from Bill Weinreb, as he explained all this. So we can only imagine what was going through their minds. I think this is something that will play out in this courtroom over and over again, the sort of re-traumatization of the people who were there that day when those bombs went off.
Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe at the trial of Johar Tsarnaev. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tough days coming up in Boston. Finally today, a little taste of the Louisiana Bayou, where you can still hear French language radio. The world's Nina Porzuki dropped in on KVPI in the town of Ville Platte and tells us this story.
It's 8 a.m. on a rainy Wednesday morning in the small town of Ville Platte, down in southwest Louisiana. Swamp country. Definitely time for a cup of coffee. Or, as they say out here in French, la tasse de café.
Phone lines are open, ladies and gentlemen. 337-363-2124, near or far, if you want to give us a call. Donnez-nous un call à ce matin. 337-363-2124.
La tasse de café is a morning radio call-in show with Jim Swallow and Mark Lane. They broadcast live from KVPI, the local commercial station. It's nothing fancy. Just a one-story brick building, one car out front, a small wooden sign, and a big American flag. This is live radio, says Mark. Nothing's really planned for the show, not the topic of conversation, not even the language.
We can talk in French, we can talk in English, we can do half and half, we call it franglais. One of the interesting topics is how you say a particular word in French, and we invite people to call in, and it's always interesting.
Like the word of the day Jim introduces this rainy morning, command.
I wonder how many people can remember this. When you command a cow,
to encourage her to get in position for milking.
Yes.
Would you know how to say that?
No.
Aha. Poto Kayet.
Turns out, a lot of folks remember.
And I'd call Jim.
All right. Bonjour. Bonjour. Qui c'est qui parle?
Jim.
Yes.
It's Gary Landrino.
Yes, Gary. Go ahead.
How you doing?
Oh, listen. We're doing okay.
This morning reminded me of a morning in January 1951. And my brother and I and he had 18 cows to milk.
French in Louisiana goes way back to the late 17th century when Europeans first settled here. About 100 years later, the Cajuns, or Acadians, arrived. Fleeing British rule in Nova Scotia, they settled down here in southwestern Louisiana. At one time, you might have traveled through small towns like Ville Platte and not have heard a lick of English.
Jim.
Uh-huh.
Becky Buller, your classmate.
Becky Buller. Bonjour, Becky.
Bonjour. Comment ça va?
But today it's different. In the 1920s, the state outlawed French in public schools. And while the Cajun and Zydeco music and the gumbo continue to thrive, Louisiana's French dialects are dwindling. In the late 1960s, around a million people reportedly spoke French in the state. The 2010 census recorded just about 175,000 native speakers. KVPI is fighting hard to buck that downward trend. The station signed on in 1953, and it has been broadcasting news and programming in French ever since. And in the town of around 8,000 people, it seems like everyone is listening. I mean, everyone.
We get the mayor. We have the mayor of Ville Platte right here who wants to make a special presentation, Jim.
All right. Oh,
good morning, bonjour, tout le monde.
Mayor Jennifer Vedrine is a force to be reckoned with.
I am from here, was born and raised right here. I wasn't reared, I was raised. You know, in the South, you're raised.
And she was raised speaking French with her grandparents. Many locals like Vedrine remember their grandparents speaking French at home and always, always listening to the radio.
KVPI is our jewel here. You know, it's so much a part of our community. I'm telling you, if you die and they don't hear it on KVPI, you're not dead.
All right, Jim, and I'll call.
Ooh, bonjour, qui c'est qui parle?
Bon matin, gentlemen, c'est Boise Pete, prêt it on.
Prêt it on, go ahead.
Hi, Boise.
Hey, Mark, I wanted to tell you all a little story en franglais.
And if KVPI has anything to do with it, French will continue to be part of the conversation here. As they say down here, lâche pas la patate. Don't give up. For the world, I'm Nina Porzucchi. Ville Platte, Louisiana.
Et tous les États-Unis, et au revoir. Wow, I'll tell you what, it was a busy one today. I wouldn't be able to stand another hour.
It was a busy one here at The World, too. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Annenberg Foundation, advancing a better tomorrow through visionary leadership today. AnnenbergFoundation.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation, by the National Endowment for the Arts, and by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.